This is Jim Fetzer, your host on Non-Random Thoughts. During the second half hour, we're going to switch gears, and we're going to talk to a man with a vast amount of experience as a structural engineer. He is an unfamiliar name to most of you, but I have, over the last several weeks, gotten to know him and had many conversations, and I'm tremendously impressed with Charles N. Pagolo. Charles is a B.S. in civil engineering from Lamar. He's got a B.S. in mathematics. He's a registered engineer in California. He has a tremendous amount of project as a project engineer, civil and structural engineer of hands-on experience. He's presently with Fulton Construction Company. He has done a great deal of work of contract engineering, a lot of it on oil rigs. And, of course, what's interesting about oil rigs is oil rigs are built out of steel, and oil rigs frequently have to confront the phenomena of fire. So here's a guy who, in my opinion, is about as well positioned to address the issues related to the Twin Towers as anyone. Charles, welcome to the show. Charles, while I catch my breath, would you please give us a sketch of what you discovered when you got into 9/11 research, especially arguments about the towers having fallen due to fire?
Well, it was quite a surprise to see it happen to begin with on the when it happened on the morning, but at that time I was on a phone with a stockbroker who had the AP wire, and he was just constantly telling me a report of explosions in there. And to me, it looked like, as it came down, it looked like a lot of sort of mushrooming clouds coming up from the bottom. You know, if you look at it, you can see it in there, that the stuff's just getting thrown out, which is not a conventional demolition.
You're talking about beams being thrown out from the top as it's exploding from the top down?
If you watch one of the collapse videos, you'll see it's about halfway down. All of a sudden, you can see, even though the building is getting sucked down, you can see all of a sudden these clouds of stuff just moving straight up and over parabolically and throwing out beams and everything else.
Well, go on. Charles,
another thing that just surprised me was that normally, if you're collapsing a building or a controlled demolition, you get big chunks of concrete. And apparently, there wasn't any concrete. It was just all blasted into. It looked to me like it was blasted into dust. It looked to me. Of course, I heard on the from the AP wire that morning there was bombs in there. So I figured that, well, 19 Arabs must have snuck in there and put bombs. Is the only thing I could think of that would bring the building down so rapidly.
Yeah, tell us about your understanding of this, the design of this structure, because so many ridiculous claims have been made. I understand from our conversations that this is simply not the kind of structure that can undergo a pancake collapse. Of course, the official story is that it was the combination of the aircraft impact and the fires that followed that weakened or melted the steel and led to the collapse. Could you comment on that,
yeah,
the general thesis the government proposes?
Yeah. Well, first of all, petroleum or jet fuel, you can ask any fireman, it's called an accelerant. It spreads the fire real rapidly, but then it burns off. And then what you're basically left with is just an office fire. And it has to be over time, quite a bit of time, that you heat steel up and weaken it. Steel is a heat sink. You can keep heating it and heating it. It's like your frying pan. It takes you a long time to get that on an electric burner or even a gas burner to get it heated up. As far as the pancake theory, that's not even applicable to steel structures. Actually, I think it seems like some of the stuff I'm seeing is that NIST is sort of backing away from that theory now. First of all, it's a fully welded structure. You may get deflections and settlement, but you wouldn't get an immediate collapse on a floor unless you took out all columns at the same time. Now, once the thing started initiating and it was progressing down, well, you could say anything about it, I guess. Once the velocity started taking it down at that point. But what I'm talking about is what actually initiated it. And I don't believe fires initiated collapse, or like they said, melted the steel, or they weakened the steel. If you go to NIST's report, they say the exterior columns didn't get hotter than 250 degrees, and as far as the interior columns, not more than 500 to 525 degrees.
Just to be clear, we're talking Fahrenheit here.
Yeah, yeah, and that's not enough to appreciably even weaken steel. And the other thing is, what you have to understand is these buildings have got huge safety factors in them. When you get into real tall structures, the design is not based on so much as the live load of the structure. What it is based on is the environmental criteria. And the environmental criteria in this case was a Pacific hurricane coming up, coming up along the coast into New York City. And what the original designers, I believe the building codes then was 90 miles an hour constant, and I think 145 instantaneous wind load. So these had tremendous wind. The wind load design on that thing was like about 10 million pounds. So the steel is predominantly dominated by the design of the environmental. And you don't see this in two-story buildings, but something like this, which is like a long, tall flagpole, this is what dominates is the wind load or the environmental load in this case. Anyway, sitting there that morning in 15-mile-an-hour winds, the thing is nine times stronger than what it needs to be. What I'm trying to say is you can knock out some columns and stuff like that, but these steel structures are redundant. They're not like a house of cards, say, that you take one out and it falls over. This thing wasn't like right at that stage where you put one more straw on a camel and you break the camel's back. This thing had tremendous reserve strength. And to explain, after the airplanes took out some columns, and then to say there's some fire, those two in combination aren't enough to take it down. It had to be a third source of destruction in there, which it seems like maybe the AP wire was right. That's the only thing I can think of.
We of course not only had the massive energy required to blow the buildings up from the top down, where Judy Wood, a mechanical engineer, has drawn the comparison with two gigantic redwoods, for example, that are turning to sawdust from the top down, but there also were concurrent explosions at some basement level approximately at the time the planes hit the building, which my guess has been, Charles, if you agree, was intended to dislodge the 47 core columns, which was the principal support from the building, from the bedrock.
Yeah.
Is that a plausible hypothesis as to what was taking place there? We have William Rodriguez, of course, who was personally present and witnessed the effects of these massive explosions, which created a great deal of debris and damage in the lobby level, for example, which couldn't possibly have come from jet fuel having come down through the elevator shafts, which were, after all, offset at several points in the building. This building was essentially three 40-story buildings, one constructed on top of the other, and there were offsets. About a third down and two-thirds down, where you'd have to get off the elevator and go to a different elevator, so there was not even any continuous elevator shaft that would have permitted jet fuel to have, hit the sub-basement level. And, of course, the kind of energy it had wouldn't have caused the massive explosions that occurred there anyway.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a real important point. A lot of this that I sort of read people don't know tend to think that this inner core shaft was just wide open and hollow like a chimney. Well, the original designers realized this and made sure that you had fire stops in there. And I understand as far as the elevators that went up all the way to the top that they even had trap doors built in there. Now, whether they closed immediately or not, probably not, but as far as all the other elevator shafts, and then these people talking about all this fuel dripping down the elevator shaft and causing these fires, what about these people? I believe there was one man who walked down from the 92nd floor. Well, why wasn't he burned alive? I mean, yeah, there's going to be smoke, but there wasn't any fire.
And of course, in the impact holes on the sides of the buildings, we have employees who work there in the building looking out. I mean, if these fires were so hot, it would presumably be preposterous for them to be in those locations at those times.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Another thing, I haven't gone back and looked at it, but you can ask any fireman. If he comes up to your house and it's on fire and all the windows are breaking out, that's a real important piece of information for him. That means the fires reach somewhere between 400 to 600 degrees. Now, this is, of course, eighth-inch glass on your house. On these things, they probably had at least half-inch plate glass, and I mean they're good enough for 800 or 900 degrees, you know. So if there was all this fire raging in 20 floors, like some people think, the windows would have exploded outward on the glass.
So the fires weren't even hot enough to cause the windows to explode, which indicates that they were well below the kind of temperatures that would have been required to even weaken the steel, much less melt it.
Yeah.
Stand by with my special guest, Charles N. Pegolo. We'll be right back. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on Non-Random Thoughts, with my special guest, Charles N. Pegolo. I'd like to emphasize that Charles is a structural engineer with a tremendous amount of hands-on experience, in particular dealing with steel structures and fires in relation to oil platforms, and very broad and diversified hands-on experience. So anyone out there who has a question, here's an opportunity, an ideal opportunity to talk with a guy who's got practically an ideal background, in my opinion, for addressing these questions. And Charles has concluded, based upon our conversation, and he can, of course, reiterate this for himself, that the official account of the collapse of the trade towers, namely that it was brought about by the combined effects of the impact of the jet aircraft with the building, the jet fuel fires that resulted from that, and the pancake collapse that was ultimately produced, is, if I might put it this way, preposterous, incompatible with the principles of engineering and your experience in this field, Charles. Would I be right in saying that?
Yeah, that's correct.
Now, we are going to take callers here, and we have one on the line right now, Alan in Texas, and I just want to let others know, here's an opportunity. If you got questions about the Twin Towers, about the design of the building, about whether or not the government's account is even remotely plausible, here's an opportunity to call in. Our line is 1-800-313-9443. 1-800-313-9443. Alan in Texas, are you there?
Yes. Mr. Pegolo, I think that you're the first structural engineer that I've actually heard talk about this from the sort of opposing or counter point of view. And I was just wondering, where did you study structural engineering?
Where did I want now?
Where did you study it, or where did you get your degree in structural engineering?
Okay, I went to one of the state colleges here in Texas. At the time, it was Lamar State College of Technology, and now it's Lamar University.
Mm-hmm.
You've heard of Texas Tech. It's sort of a sister school in the south part of the state where Texas Tech's in the north.
I see. Mm-hmm. And
you want me to relate his vita, Alan? You know, I did introduce it and explain his background, but he has a vast amount of experience with some of the biggest companies in this field, contract engineering with Paragon Engineering, contract engineering with Reading and Bates, contract engineering doing stuff for Bechtel, for Global Industries, even for Brown and Root, stuff with Conoco, with Hudson, McDermott, you know, both in Houston, with King, Wilkinson Limited, Earl and Wright Construction Engineering. I'm explaining that this man has a vast amount of experience, especially with oil rigs, which are steel structures that have a lot of fires, okay?
Oh,
so
yeah, no.
If you have a question for Charles, please present it.
My question would be, there's a lot of speculation about the nature of the explosive properties at the top of the building when after the collapse initiates.
Uh-huh.
And there's a group of people that are speculating that there was, you know, what type of extra energies or extra devices created that explosive properties, the gigantic clouds, ejecting stuff out the sides. Now, I know that's not your field of expertise, but in your opinion,
I had a little experience from the military on explosives, which is, you know, mainly C4 and that type of stuff. But and I've certainly studied it. I have studied damage studies of offshore platforms in the Persian Gulf. Say, if you remember during the 80s, if a mine ran into a platform, what can we expect, you know? So, and I've looked at other assessments of rig accidents and stuff like that. But as far as the strength of this structure, this structure had a lot of strength. The original designers, and you can look back, I think it was about 1970, the landlord of the Empire State Building, I guess, didn't want all this competition of more office space in southern Manhattan, and he started saying the design was unsafe and all that. Anyway, it came out then from Leslie Robinson, and he was quoting a structural engineer. And one of the things he said, and this is phenomenal, that you could cut all the exterior columns on one side plus a few of the others going up the other side, and the structure would withstand a 100-mile-an-hour wind and not collapse.
Mm-hmm. And, well, thanks a lot for answering that. And one real quick thing.
Because I think the answer to your question, therefore, turns out to be it would have to be a massive source of energy to take down this extraordinarily well-constructed building, a massive source of energy. Now, I know, of course, Steve Jones has been trying to figure out how it was done, has proposed that thermate, as a combination of thermite plus sulfur, may have been responsible for cutting the steel. And that's an incendiary that functions to cut the steel, but it isn't an explosive. He has, however, suggested that a nanotechnology-enhanced version called super thermite also has explosive properties. Now, whether that would be sufficient to bring about the combined effects is, in my opinion, an open question. I think it may well be that the thermate was combined with other explosives, such as RDX. There's a rag version of RDX that's incredibly explosive, and who knows, that might have been used there too. Stand by, Alan, and we'll continue after the break. This moment in this case may well be having a bona fide hands-on structural engineer with extensive experience dealing with steel structures and fire, Charles Pegelow. We have a series of callers lined up. So, Alan, if you'd like to ask one more question, please address it to Charles.
Sure. Actually, what I would just want to say is that for the laymen that are listening like me, could you – I know that the actual plans for the World Trade Centers are sort of tucked away somewhere where nobody can see them except for some investigators, but could you just give a brief explanation, if possible, of the difference between a building like the World Trade Center, which was innovative at the time, and something like the Sears Tower with its non-curtain wall type of construction? And thank you.
Thanks very much, Alan.
Okay, well, I would assume, I've never examined or looked at the Sears Tower. I would assume that it was pretty similar in method of construction that the World Trade Center was, which is sort of a tube within a tube, only because once you get to that height, that becomes, because your predominant strength needs to be against overturning in the wind. So I would assume that the Sears Tower in Chicago is about the same, or anything, Petroglass Towers or anything like that. One other thing I'd like to mention to him is that he was asking about what I think happened. What I think the only way to take this building down is that you had to take that center core and drop it. And once you drop that, the building's gone. But that's a lot of exercise taking that out. Normally in a demolition, you strip the building of all of its architectural features, piping, hazmat, and everything else, carpet. And what you do is you go down there and you cut the flanges of all the beams. And then what you're left with is a web. And then you put explosive charges on the web, and then you blow it, and then it comes down. You had to start. What I think is you had to start weakening the structure initially. And that appears that what might be going on, where Jones has noticed that the evidence of thermite coming out of the corners of corner columns of the building. So I think that's what happened. And then the other thing is, I think you had to have a third thing. I think there had to be a tremendous shock wave in this thing. And like I said, because of the concrete busting up, what each floor had was 4 inches of concrete. It was tied by sheer connectors to the trusses. Also, these floors had, I believe it was about 10 inches on center, had rebar in them. So that is a strong slab with rebar. And somehow for it all to turn into powder, it just doesn't make sense by falling down. There ought to be some chunks, especially when it's reinforced by rebar.
Terrific, Charles. We're going to take some more callers. Gene in Texas, you're on with Charles Pegelow. Gene, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Please.
I saw some documentaries on the original construction of the Twin Towers in the early 70s, and they were going to be so tall they were concerned at that time, they said, about airplanes hitting the buildings.
Right.
And that they built those buildings originally to compensate for airplanes hitting the buildings even.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Frank DeMartini, who was the construction manager, the project manager for the World Trade Towers, was interviewed and explained how the intricate lattice structure and the very sophisticated load redistribution capabilities built into the 47 core columns made it such that for the largest then commercial airliners, which were Boeing 707s, which are very comparable in their size and mass and fuel capacity to the 767s that actually hit the building, it would be analogous to sticking a pencil through mosquito netting. So what you're saying is exactly right. I found at least three other engineers who were involved in the construction of the buildings who said essentially the same thing, though they didn't use the same colorful metaphor.
Well, also, I heard on these documentaries that the owner of the building, Larry Silverstein, was going to have to replace, or not replace, but take out a lot of asbestos that was put into the Twin Towers originally in the early 70s before asbestos was condemned, and that was going to cost him a pretty penny to do that. And, of course, he bought those buildings in the summer of 2001, just before they came down, and apparently he didn't know about the asbestos until after he bought them. But, you know, it saved him a pretty penny from having to do that, those Twin Towers coming down. And I heard he got $3.5 billion in insurance money.
Just 6 weeks before the buildings, before 9/11, he insured them for $3.5 billion. And after the attacks, he insisted that there were two attacks. And my understanding is he was awarded actually twice that amount as a consequence of his claim. But it is extremely interesting, and there are a number of us who speculate that there may be a case for an insurance fraud between Larry Silverstein and Securicom, the company that was responsible for security here, a member of whose board of directors was Marvin Bush, brother of the president, and whose chief executive officer was Wirt Walker III, a Bush cousin.
One more item. Larry Silverstein also said in a documentary that he personally told him to pull building number 7 because of supposed all the damage that it had incurred by the fall of the Twin Towers.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
It was a
PBS interview where he said that he had suggested to the fire captain to pull it, that they made the decision to pull and they watched the building come down. That, of course, is an expression for a controlled demolition, and if there were that implies there had to be previously positioned explosives. If they were in Building 7, why not in 1 and 2?
Exactly. Well, I really appreciate your program and your guest on the program.
Thanks, Gene. Thanks for calling in. We have another caller, Mike in Texas. Mike, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Professor and Charles. My question is to Charles. Charles, how strong was each floor in the towers? It's my understanding that this was a Class A building, that in New York City the code states that each floor has to be able to withhold 5 times its own weight.
Okay, I'm not sure about that. You've got what you call design loads.
Yes, sir.
And for offices, if that's what it is, office floors, it'll be 100 pounds per square foot, or it might be 80 plus partition loads of 20 pounds per square foot. In the central core, of course, that's not office. A lot of that's mechanical. And it would be a different flooring system in the central core. It would be just steel beams and a center storage, mechanical rooms, stuff like that. The floors there were probably designed for more load.
All right. Well, that was my question. Thanks for coming coming out, Charles, and another credible person to discuss the truth about the buildings. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling, Mike. We have another caller, Leon in Texas. Leon, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Well, every time I hear one of these discussions, something is forgotten. And that is that aluminum burns and that there's 110 tons of aluminum in that plane. And when that much aluminum burns, it gives off about the same amount of heat as 300 tons of coal. Now, you can look it up. And aluminum ignites at about 1180 degrees Fahrenheit. So that has to be in the calculations when you're saying it's impossible for them to have fallen down.
Leon, do you realize that if the structure had weakened, then it would have had a completely different style of collapse? It would not have been complete, abrupt, and sudden that those buildings came down the South Tower in 10 seconds? Do you realize that that's faster than free fall against air resistance, which would take at least 12? Do you have any possible explanation for how that could have been the result of a pancake collapse meeting resistance at every floor, which consumes time to overcome?
I'm afraid I have to do a little business here. But I want you guys to think about the fact that aluminum does burn. You don't need any thermite. Bye-bye.
Thanks for calling, Leon. Is there anything you care to add, Charles?
Yeah, well, the problem is you just can't take a sheet of aluminum and put it next to some rusty steel and have it go off. It doesn't happen. You have to, pulverize it and mix it in a certain area. As far as the aluminum at 1180 degrees, it starts burning. But the problem is even the NIST in their report said temperatures weren't much more than 500 degrees.
So it would not have got hot enough to reach the ignition point for aluminum.
Yeah. And the other thing is, where the structure of the plane entered the building, those panels were knocked off. But that's another indication that where's this temperature gradient of 1180 degrees Fahrenheit? When you can look at the pictures of the aluminum cladding on the outside of the building, and none of those are warping or bending.
The steel siding.
Well, no, you had aluminum cladding over the steel.
Okay. Okay.
What I'm saying, even at the entrances, the holes, you know, if you had 1100 degrees, you'd expect that aluminum to start warping. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You're saying there was aluminum covering over the steel plates that actually constituted the external perimeter covering. And that if it had got that hot, they would have peeled and shown different behavioral properties as a consequence of the heat. They did not show those, which means there was not that heat.
Well, not in the outside, anyway.
Yeah.
And, okay, I assume some aluminum panels got kicked inside, but the aluminum isn't just going to start burning by itself, and you know, you got to get up to 1180 degrees, like Mike said, and NIST said they didn't get over 500 or 525 Fahrenheit. So, you know, there's a problem there. What he says is correct, but the problem is the temperatures didn't get that high.
Excellent. We have another caller. We have Roger in Pennsylvania. Roger, are you there? Roger, are you there?
Yeah. Thanks, gentlemen. Yeah. There's one thing that. Even from day one, I really stank in the establishment official explanation relied on the pancaking of the initial one or two floors upon which all the others are said to have pancaked. Now, the theory was that you had to have a certain amount of percentage of sagging of each of those cross or initiating cross members, which are then said to have pulled loose from the end rivets, allowing those cross members to collapse. And it strikes me that somebody with just a tiny bit of metallurgical savvy, which would be any more than I have, could easily dismiss that by the requirement that they get a certain percentage of sagging would require so many 100,000 degrees to achieve that percentage. Before that could happen, and that would have to be spread over considerable lengths of the beams, not merely narrow areas.
Excellent points. Plus, the diagrams that are typically offered in support of that theory ignore the 47 core columns that were the principal source of support for the building. They just ignore it. They pretend they don't exist. Even the 9/11 commission claimed that the center of the building was just hollow. That's completely ridiculous, dishonest, and deceitful.
But the core columns aside, it still required the pulling apart from the ends. So could you address that and hopefully...
Charles?
Yeah. Let me talk about the pancake theory. First of all, there's been a lot of disinformation going around. One is that these weak bolts fractured and fell apart. Yeah, there was bolts holding both ends of these trusses in, but those are what's called erection bolts. You initially have to hook it together. And then afterwards, they come in on the seat of the joist, which is most of the time is two angles back to back. You go in there and you run a fillet weld around it. So these were welded up. And another thing, there's been tests by the British steel industry, full scale test of floors similar to this. And yeah, when fires get very hot, you start getting sagging. You can get sagging in the floors, but don't forget you've got that 4-inch concrete, which actually is acting like a top flange, that's all going in compression. And what they showed was some of their studies, and as a matter of fact, it's even in the NIST's report, and I think it's in Section A I believe it's called the Carrington test in Britain. And what they show is that the floors should have survived whatever temperatures were in there. I mean, they're going up to over 1,000 degrees, I believe, on their test. So, you know, this pancake theory is something that doesn't hold up. It's a phenomenon that doesn't happen in steel structures. Pancake collapses happen mainly in a certain type of concrete construction. And this is not all concrete, just certain type. And this is where you put your columns in and you pour a slab, and around each column you've got a pocket. And once it's cured by 2 days, you come in and you pour another slab. And then you lift these slabs up one by one. You see the pockets, the columns sliding in them. And then once you get them up there, then you tie them off to the columns. And this is where sometimes there's problems. They're not tied off secure enough, or construction. A lot of times these accidents happen in construction, and by the time the last one gets there, it falls down. But you understand they're not even connected to the columns except by some construction jacks at the time. And then, of course, the other times they get collapses, they had a lot of these in Mexico during the 70s on apartment buildings during earthquakes. So I don't know. I just have a feeling that their concrete wasn't mixed right. They cheated on as much rebar as they needed or something like that. But anyway, that's a conventional pancake collapse. It doesn't happen in steel buildings.
And, Charles, when it's all said and done, don't you have a stack of floors there on top of one another, which is the reason it's called pancake?
Yeah, you're right. They exactly pancake down. Now, they're all busted up, but they don't turn to dust.
Thank you very much. Excellent.
Thank you.
Okay. I'd like to just mention one other thing that Gene had said about Larry Silverman. He did Silverstein. He did not own World Trade Center 1 and 2. His company owned 7. But 1 and 2, he had a 99-year lease to go turn around and re-lease the property. So what his lawsuit was the loss of rental that he had on this complex, that he had just taken this lease out. And the other thing is, Gene had mentioned about the buildings in 1968 were designed for an airplane running into them, which is real reasonable, understanding that the same thing had happened in 1949 with a B-29 in the fog had run into the Empire State Building. So that's a real reasonable thing to expect them to design it for.
Excellent. Well, next caller, Robert in Rhode Island. Robert, are you there?
Hello?
Yes, Robert, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? I have a question. A previous caller mentioned aluminum and a melting temperature of aluminum. And so that brings up the question of the Camera Planet video. It's available on ST911. It's the infamous video which shows the dripping, molten, orange, sparking substance that's coming from the corner of WCT2 prior to the collapse, but after the plane had gone into it. And my question for the guest is, do you believe that this is aluminum? I know that aluminum is generally has silvery qualities during the daylight, as stated by Dr. Stephen Jones. Is it iron, which definitely has a higher melting temperature and is a byproduct of a chemical reaction on this thermite? Or a more recent argument has been that it's oxygen tanks from the plane, but the oxygen tends to dissipate very quickly upon being punctured.
This is an extremely interesting question. We'll see if Charles is... what Charles has to say about it when we come back from our next break. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on Non-Random Thoughts, with my special guest, Charles Pegalo, who's a very experienced structural engineer with a great deal of hands-on dealing with steel structures and fire. I want to just mention for the list of callers here, we aren't going to be able to get you all on today, but I want to assure you that I'm going to have Charles back. He's got a wealth of experience for us to draw upon. And here, for a change, you have a structural engineer who's willing to address the issues, unlike the many others who have to know the truth about the collapse of the Twin Towers and are too cowardly to speak out. We have an interesting question from Robert in Rhode Island. Charles, are you able to address it? You may or may not have seen the film footage he's talking about.
I'm not sure if I've seen the film footage, but I've heard this about these oxygen tanks. One thing, oxygen tanks on planes, they're the smaller size. I'm used to E tanks, which are the big ones, and I think these are like A or B tanks. Most, I don't know about those small oxygen tanks, but usually these things have some sort of pressure relief on these tanks. They got like almost half-inch steel, and you don't want those tanks blowing up. You want it to relieve itself before you get there. So I assume this has had some sort of relief valve on it. The other thing is, if this thing relieved itself of oxygen, I mean, the fire's starved. I don't see where this oxygen is going to do anything except help the existing fire with more oxygen.
And we still have the black billowing smoke indicative of an oxygen-deprived fire.
Right, right. So I think it would get used up pretty rapidly as a gas. The other thing is, and I'm not sure if he was trying to connect this to what Professor Jones, what I had seen on Internet video is on the corner, actually several places, but it was like on a corner of a building, there was evidence of thermite. So if you look at the way the plane went in, if this was an oxygen tank, how did it get over there in the corner?
Yes,
I mean, it had a momentum going through the plane. It may have just gone out the other side of the building, for all I know. So I don't think this is not indicative of throwing oxygen on something that's burning that all of a sudden you start seeing this aluminum. I'm not even sure if those small oxygen tanks, what they're made of, if they're made of steel or aluminum. I would have thought they were made of steel. The big ones are, the E-tanks are, so I don't know what these are.
But, those are the three main theories that are out now, the aluminum, the iron, and the more recent, within the last couple of weeks, debunkers have put forth this oxygen theory. And I've seen film tests of the oxygen tanks being broken off, and the oxygen does dissipate quite quickly. It sparks a bit when you set a fire, but it really goes quickly. And,
Robert, you're terrific. What I'm going to do is ask Charles to take a look at some of that film footage we're talking about, and I'm going to get him back on to address it further in great detail. Thank you for calling.
It. Thank you.
We're going to try Don in Ohio. Don, are you there?
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I wanted to point out something about the interest that Larry Silverstein had in insuring the leases.
Yes.
I haven't heard much discussion about Frank Lowy, who was a former Israeli Golani Brigade participant in the 1950s, and his recent purchase of malls throughout the United States from Dick Jacobs, the former...
Don, I'm really sorry we can't pursue this. This is very interesting. I hope that you will you call back in when I have Charles Pegelow on again. I want to thank everyone for calling in and to assure you I'm going to have Charles back. Charles, in the meanwhile, I want to thank you so much for coming on Non-Random Thoughts. Thanks to everyone for listening. Thank you.